Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Smith, Judge Connolly, Judge Harris, the Honorable Tracy M. Smith presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome, everybody, to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Welcome. I think we have some interns here from County. Is that right? Welcome. We're happy to have you. Today is July 10th, 2024. We have four cases on our oral calendar. And the first one is A23-1290, State of Minnesota versus Travis Clay Anderson. Counsel, each of you has 15 minutes for your principal argument. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use it. The podium toggles up and down to adjust to your height. We are making an oral recording right now. We're live streaming, but only audio recording will be on our website later. So with that, I think we are ready for appellant. Please state your name and a party you represent for the record.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is DeVee Axelson. I represent the appellant, Travis Anderson. For purposes of today's argument, I'm going to focus on the implicit bias of Juror 23 and on AE's testimony that harassment restraining order, an HRO, was successfully passed by a district court judge on her behalf. First, I want to address the state's motion to strike. There's two different bases that the state used to strike the reply brief in this case, and neither is applicable. First is the argument that we're raising a new issue. In fact, it is just a response providing supplemental authority regarding the issue that's raised in our brief regarding implicit bias. Second is the indication that, that we are not responding to the state's brief. And in fact, it is a direct response to the state's brief. The thrust, I think, of the state's argument on issue one was that there wasn't one of these delineated rules in 2602 subdivision 5 paren 1 that lists what reasons are considered actual implicit bias. And so we are directly responding to that by providing one of those reasons to justify why there's implicit bias in this case. And there's also two other bases to justify reviewing that rule in this case. One is that the Minnesota Civil Appellate Rules 12805 allow parties to supplement the authorities after a brief has been filed and even after oral argument has taken place. And so this could be considered part of those supplemental authorities. Additionally, and importantly, the Supreme Court in State v. Hanuskala, which is 452 Northwest 2nd, 668, pinpoint site 673, note 7, says, it is the responsibility of appellate courts to decide cases in accordance with law, and that responsibility is not to be diluted by counsel's oversights, lack of research, failure to specify issues, or to cite relevant authorities. Here, this court has that rule before it, and it should apply that rule in this case and find that Juror 23 was implicitly biased in this case because she had been an employee of AE and had taken care of AE's children.
Run to the merits of it now of your argument. So I didn't really necessarily see a challenge on this, but how it sounds like she was employed by a daycare facility, not directly by, this person was a client, right? The victim was a client of that facility?
The victim, or AE in this case, the alleged victim at least, was listed as, or she had used a daycare facility that Juror 23 had worked at.
But she didn't directly employ that person.
No, but I don't think that the rule is specific enough to delineate whether the person works for a company that they work at or that they employ.
Following up on Judge Smith's excellent question, she wasn't a nanny in AE's home, right?
That's correct.
Okay.
So didn't continuing employment to her or anything like that? What about the currency of the employment?
Well, I think when you look at the plain language of the rule, it doesn't say anything about current employee or current employer. It just says employee or employer. It also says standing, but it doesn't say current standing in the rule. And so I think the lack of you know, any language in the rule about recency of the employment or employer makes it that the plain language essentially applies for somebody who's been an employee of the aggrieved party in the case.
Because it seems like the implied bias would have to do with that you might actually favor your employer because you're sort of subject to them for your salary, for what, you know. But if it's a past employer, it seems like it's someone that you've just known, like many other people.
Well, I think the connection here is that once you've had somebody under your employ, that they have that connection. And here we have an employee who worked on AE's children's behalf for over 4 years. So we don't have a passing, employment-employee relationship where it was, they maybe worked in the same building and didn't have any direct contact with AE's children. Here we specifically know that based on the statements that she made to the district court judge, that she had worked with both children over 4 years. And I think anybody who's familiar with the relationship with a daycare provider and a child knows how close that relationship is.
So does under the rule, whether the implied bias applies depend on the extent then of the contact with the employer then? If it were a week, it wouldn't count, or?
I don't think it does. I think that that's helpful in this case and strengthening our argument, but I think that the, at least in Fraga, again, this is a direct quote from Fraga at page 6, or in pinpoint site 622, it says, "We have already described in Rule 2602 the circumstances when prospective jurors are too connected in a case at issue to sit." And so if there is that connection under one of these 2602 subdivision 5 paren 1 listed rules, that shows that it's too attenuated. We have a situation here where there were two alternate jurors. The district court had an easy role to play in this case. Once the district court had realized that the connection between juror 23 and AE in this case and failed to replace one of those alternative jurors, as the district court judge had done in Manley and was supported by this court in the Manley decision, which is cited in our brief. Additionally, under Steffelbein, which is cited in the state's brief, in Steffelbein, that connection was not close enough because it was the victim's father who owned the company and had employed the workers at that company, and it wasn't the actual aggrieved party in Steffelbein as we do have here.
So it would be your position, even if the daycare provider hadn't been taking care of the children for 40 years, she'd still be subject to implicit bias?
I think under the plain language of the rule, that would be the result that we would request. I think it strengthens our case here because of the close connection. But under implicit bias, I think it starts and ends at whether there's an employee-employer relationship, as there was here. I do want to touch, too, on the at least one of the other issues in this case, and that's regarding the introduction of testimony. And I would say, assuming arguendo, that there is some merit to the state's argument that the defense opened the door to some testimony by AE about why she didn't initially apply for an HRO and why she eventually did apply for an HRO. But the decision by the district court judge to grant that HRO is very different from AE's mindset. That's totally independent. It doesn't establish AE's mindset whether a judge grants or doesn't grant that order. Instead, what that tells the jury, as it was told by the told to the jury in Maryland, is that it's an independent body, and here a district court judge, reviewed the facts regarding whether or not a harassment restraining order should be granted, the same facts that are before the jury in this case, and granted that motion. You're essentially telling the jury that a judge has already reviewed the facts that you are reviewing and has found that a harassment restraining order should be granted to AE. And that's a huge problem in this case, and this court has discussed something similar also in Hogvet, where it said that a cop is not permitted to testify about that he believed that Mr. Hogvet had assaulted his mother. But I think more importantly in Muralin, which is directly on point and has the exact same facts essentially, except for here it involves a judge versus a school board, is that an independent party has evaluated the facts and has ruled that the facts support this granting of that. Now, I understand that the defense counsel, instead of objecting to that, tried to make an argument that there was a lesser burden of proof and asked AE about, wasn't that a civil procedure versus a criminal? While we may understand that as attorneys and as judges, I don't believe that the jury would understand that to that level. And, you know, all they're hearing is that a judge has already independently reviewed these facts and agreed with AE that she was deserving of a harassment restraining order.
So you don't think this is invited error by his lawyer?
No, because his lawyer, if he invited anything, and if there's a argument regarding opening the door, it would be significantly limited to AE's mindset. You know, why she didn't initially ask for the HRO, why she may have asked for the HRO later. The judge in granting that order does not speak to AE's mindset whatsoever. That just shows that is totally independent, that he did not open the door to that determination, because it doesn't speak to AE's mindset, which is clear that part of this case is determining both Mr. Anderson's mindset and AE's mindset. And the judge's granting of that is an independent body who can't speak to AE's mindset, but has reviewed the facts in this case and has determined that an HRO should be granted.
So would you agree, are we reviewing this for plain error then?
Yes, reviewing this for plain error.
So, you know, speaking for myself and not my treasured colleagues, there does seem to be overwhelming evidence in this case to convict your client. So why were his substantial rights violated?
Well, I think that in Maryland too, there was also, you know, significant evidence affecting, you know, the jury's ability to evaluate the record fairly. I think in Hogvet, there was, again, independent of the police officer's testimony, there was strong evidence of the guilt of Mr. Hogvet. And I think that the issue is actually before the Supreme Court right now about, you know, this court is not supposed to evaluate prejudicial error based on the sufficiency of the evidence. It's supposed to evaluate what the effect of the error had on the jury. And I think it's really easy in a case like this where the jury is told that an independent judge has already determined based on these facts that a harassment restraining order should be granted, that the jury knows that their job is easy at that point, that some of the innocuous things.
The jury's never heard of the Court of Appeals that sometimes reverses district court decisions if they're wrong.
Can you repeat that again?
You know, don't you think juries also know that there's this thing called the appellate court, which sometimes declares a judgment made by the district court in granting a restraining order in error?
I don't believe that the normal lay juror knows anything about the appellate courts. I think they maybe have heard of the U.S. Supreme Court.
They seem to be on Law and Order all the time.
I don't watch Law and Order, but from speaking to people at parties and when I tell them what I do, they're often have no idea what that process is like, and I have to explain pretty intricately.
So, but they would know the complicated process involving harassment restraining orders.
Well, I think that they would know that a judge has made a determination in this case that a harassment restraining order should be granted.
And in this day and age, with the public's mind on what the Supreme Court of the United States may or may not be doing, you think that's going to sway them, that a judge issued a restraining order, and they're, by God, he must be guilty in this case?
I think this court said in Maryland that a school board making a determination regarding whether somebody should be hired or fired was enough to tip the balance in that case. And I think that a judge's decision would hold more weight. Judges are held in high esteem.
20 years ago. You don't think I'm not so sure in this current environment there is that much deference for judicial decisions as there was at one time. So I guess I respectfully disagree that tipped the scales against your client, but I'll just leave it at that.
Unless there's additional questions, I would cede the rest of my time. Thank you.
Counsel, I do have a question.
Okay.
You're framing this in the framework of the judge granting the HRO, but my reading of the transcript was this was opened through testimony on cross-examination to AE as to why she did not get an HRO in her response on, I guess, her response when she was questioned about it was to explain her mindset. So again, in that context, how is there plain error when one, it was your client's attorney who opened the door to these questions, two, your client did not object at the time, and three, your client on redirect then questioned AE as it relates to the difference between a civil matter and a criminal matter?
Well, I guess we would differ in the fact that I don't think she was ever asked by defense counsel, did you attempt or did you successfully get a HRO when you first started receiving contact from Mr. Anderson? The question is, did you apply for? And I think that this court sounds like they're pretty set on the fact that that opened the door to some of her answers on whether or not she had applied for an HRO. And again, that speaks to, I see that I'm running out of time, but if I could finish
my
point.
Go ahead, please.
I think that speaks to her mindset, and which is has some relevancy to this case. But what an independent judge does in granting or not granting that HRO is independent of that. And I don't believe any of the questions by defense counsel asked for that determination. I think that the state took advantage of some of the questions to go past what they were permitted to under the opening of the door standard, and that's the problem here. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Nick Hajdukovic. I'm a special assistant Carver County attorney, and I represent the respondent, State of Minnesota. This court should affirm the appellant's convictions for harassing the woman who prosecuted him on previous occasions because the appellant received a fair trial to an unbiased jury. And I want to respond to the arguments counsel made, and I'll start with the juror issue, since that's where counsel started. First of all, I think the principal brief of the appellant, as well as the argument counsel made at the district court for striking the juror, were very clearly focused on the juror's allegedly close relationship with AE's children as their daycare provider, not on any claim of employment. And in fact, in the standard of review section in the principal brief, the appellant frames this issue as the question of whether to extend the doctrine of implied bias is reviewed de novo. And so if there's going to be an extension, we wouldn't need to look at an employer relationship. That's already in the rule and recognized as a form of implied bias. So I think that tells the story about whether the issue is properly before the court. But even examining on the merits, there's really no merit to the claim. There's just no evidence in the record to demonstrate that as a legal matter, Juror 23 was an employee of AE. I think our common sense and even my very limited knowledge of employment law would seem to indicate otherwise, that by all accounts, from what it appears, Juror 23 is an employee of the child care facility where she works. And presumably, if this is like my own experience, AE would have contracted with that facility for daycare services. So that doesn't create any sort of employee-employer relationship. And the other piece that the court pointed out during counsel's argument is the timing of the relationship. The rule regarding an employee or employer uses the terminology that a person, quote, standing as a employer, employee, of someone alleged to have been injured by the defense or offense or whose complaint instituted the prosecution. That's in the present tense, not the past tense. And if we look further in the rule, specifically numbers 8 through 10 of that rule, which give other bases for implied bias, we see verbs in the past tense. Service on the jury that found the indictment or an indictment on a related offense. Service on a trial jury that tried another person for the same or related offense. Service on a jury previously sworn to try the pending charges. So when these rules were written, I think they were written intentionally with the specific verb tense in mind. Sometimes it's the past tense, sometimes it's the present tense. And so here we don't have, certainly don't have any present employer-employee relationship. So even on the merits, that claim cannot exist. The bottom line from the state's perspective here is that if a juror is actually biased, of course the defendant has a right to have that juror struck from the jury for cause. But when there's not actual bias, the Supreme Court has made very clear that there are only very limited circumstances where we will say because of your status, regardless of whether you have actual bias, you are going to be excluded from this jury. This case doesn't meet one of those. And that's the bottom line, and that's why the argument must fail.
Counsel, serving as a daycare provider for children who are in and of themselves victims as well, doesn't that create bias, regardless of whether or not it's present or in the past, the fact that you were a daycare provider for multiple years?
Well, again, there's two responses to that, at least two responses. I would say not necessarily as my initial response, because it's going to depend on the individual facts and circumstances. A person could just know someone who's a victim of a crime in some way in the community, and it doesn't necessarily mean they're excluded from jury service. We just have to look at the individual facts and circumstances, and that's why we have the ability to strike for actual bias.
Counsel, given the specific circumstances of this case where the juror was for 4 years a care provider for two of the victims, children, and quite frankly, the children themselves are victims, doesn't that create some type of bias?
I would say no, not as a matter of law. I think it just depends on the facts. And I would push back. I understand the court's characterization of the children as victims, and in a sort of colloquial sense, they probably are. But as a legal matter, they are not. The harassment statute under which appellant was charged, one of the ways that can be proven, one of the elements is that the person being harassed, that being AE in this case, reasonably believed that household or family members would be placed in danger of substantial bodily harm or something like that. So the children don't have to have any knowledge of appellant's actions in order for the state to meet the element using that criteria. And there's different criteria the state can use to meet that element, and that's just one of those. It's disjunctive. But I would push back on them being victims as in the legal sense in this case. And I think that, again, the Supreme Court has made clear that these bases for strikes for cause for implied bias have to be construed narrowly. We're not expanding that list. The Supreme Court's made that very clear. Even in the Fraga case where the two of the jurors actually knew that the defendant had been previously convicted of the same crime because it was a retrial, that wasn't enough to create implied bias. And I would submit that that's far more biasing type of information than what we have here. You could imagine, too, a situation where there's a school teacher of a child, maybe has a child in class for a year, and then maybe several years later, the child is sort of peripherally involved in a crime. The teacher may be actually biased, but if they're not, they're certainly not an employee of the victim. And here, this juror 23 characterized herself as a teacher, albeit in a childcare facility rather than in a school, but I think the analogy is the same. There may be actual bias, but in this case, there wasn't. And if there's not actual bias, we only exclude people if they meet those very limited criteria delineated in the rule. And I think that's important for people who are potential jurors as well, because the courts have certainly recognized the importance of not excluding people unnecessarily from jury service. But obviously, on the other hand, the defendant has the right to a fair and impartial jury, and that's why we have strikes for cause for actual bias. With regard to the HRO issue, counsel did concede that we're looking at plain error review, and I think that's important in the context of opening the door, because plain error, of course, not only requires error, but error that clearly contravenes a statute, a rule, or binding case law. And it's going to be very difficult, I think, in most situations where someone opens the door to other evidence coming in to find plain error, because those are very fact-dependent situations. They depend not only on the specific facts of the case, but how the facts are presented in a trial. And this case is no exception to that. This case presents very specific and, frankly, very unusual facts. And the fact is that there is no binding case law that I'm aware of that would have required the judge in this case to sua sponte step in and say, no, this isn't admissible.
So if I'm looking at the right part of the transcript, mm-hmm. there was a question, you know, if you believe, you know, asking why she didn't get before, and it said, I did not believe he would follow it, and I felt that it would encourage additional behavior. Question, since March 1st, 2022, have you gotten a harassment restraining order against defendant? Right, that's where we're at.
Yes.
And then she says yes. Okay, so what would be the relevance of that question since the date, March 1st is the date of the incident, right?
Correct.
Okay, so why would that be a relevant question?
Sure. Two responses to that. First, one thing I did want to note and I don't want to forget is just the nature of the question is not did a judge issue a restraining order, but have you gotten one? And so again, obviously we know that a judge issues that, but it's not making it obvious to the jury that a judge is putting in any sort of imprimatur of propriety on this. But putting that piece aside in terms of the actual relevance, one of the pillars of the appellant's theory of the case at trial was that AE was either exaggerating or completely fabricating the fear she felt from as a result of the appellant's actions. And part of their argument was, well, you never went out and got an HRO. If you were so afraid of this guy, why didn't you apply for an HRO? And that question was answered, as you just discussed, Your Honor. And but if she had not gotten an HRO after this, I think it could send a message to the jury that, maybe she really isn't afraid of this guy. It's conduct that would arguably be inconsistent with her testimony and therefore impeaching. So it really just clears that up to say, yep, I went out and got an HRO after this because of how afraid I was. She didn't say those words, but that's the clear implication of that.
What is your response to Mr. Axelson's argument that, you know, because a judge issued this restraining order, obviously the entire jury is just going to roll over?
I do disagree with that very much because, first of all, as I indicated, the testimony wasn't explicitly that the judge issued it. Now, that's implicit, I think, but at least to us it is. To a jury, it may not be that clear. But counsel did make very clear, and I thought very effectively, in his questioning of AE, and she readily agreed to all these things, that HROs are very different than the crime of harassment in terms of not just the burden of proof, but that they're civil, not criminal, that they come from different statutes, and that they require proof of different facts and elements. So I think counsel made it abundantly clear to the jury that the fact that these two things both have the word harassment in them doesn't mean that they're the same thing. I don't think that fact could have really been made a whole lot clearer to the jury. So from that, as well as the overwhelming nature of the evidence against the appellant, which I can certainly address, as well as the fourth prong of plain error analysis. And the appellant obviously has to show error that's plain, that affected substantial rights, and that failure to correct any error would cause the public to seriously question the fairness and integrity of the judicial system. The appellant has to demonstrate all four of those, and from the state's perspective, hasn't demonstrated any of them. And I think it's a big reach to say all four of those things have been demonstrated. One thing I did want to do also is just note that this case is very different from Mirland, where a teacher, I believe it was, at a school was found with child pornography on their workplace computer, and the state elicited evidence that the defendant, Mirland, was subsequently fired from his job after that was found on his computer. There, the firing had nothing to do with the merits of the case. Here, the HRO does have something to do with the merits of the case in terms of really refuting the appellant's theory of the case. And so in that sense, Mirland is differentiated, is distinguishable from this case, and that's particularly important because, again, we're in a plain error standard of review. And if that's the closest case to being on point, it certainly doesn't rise to the level of plain error that clearly would have required Judge Wilton to intervene here. And with that, Your Honors, I don't have any additional argument that I want to make at this time. I'm happy to answer any questions the court might have. Otherwise, I would waive the remainder of my time.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
And any rebuttal?
Just a couple of things, Your Honor. Whether this court, or so directly in my standard of review on the first issue, my exact statement is whether this court should apply the implied bias doctrine to the facts of this case is reviewed de novo on appeal. So I'm not asking, I didn't ask this court to extend the implied bias doctrine to the facts of this case. I'm just asking it to apply the implied bias doctrine to the facts of this case, which is different than Fraga, where none of the listed reasons under 2602 applied, and that's part of the reason Fraga was unsuccessful. I don't understand the state's argument at all that AE's children were not listed victims in this case. The jury was instructed about AE's family or household members and the substantial harm done to them, and the family or household member definition included AE's children. They are direct victims in this case. To Mirland, I don't know how Mirland isn't almost exactly, if not exactly, the facts of this case, only we're talking about a school board versus a judge. You essentially have an independent party who's making, the jury is hearing a comment about the credibility of the facts of the case from that independent party. Here, I would argue that it's worse because it involves a judge, and I don't agree with the state that Mirland didn't involve the facts of the case. Mirland is fired for the possession of child pornography on his work computer, and those were the facts that he's charged with at trial. And
counsel, can you address the argument that looking at 2602, particularly under a statutory interpretation lens, that subdivision 516 is drafted in the present tense, that meaning it was a present relationship, and there is throughout other parts of that rule drafting in the past tense. Given that lens, if this is a present tense, doesn't that just foreclose on any argument that there was a current employer relationship if we found that?
I guess I, again, don't agree with counsel here regarding that. I think that there's a discussion of previously, so the past tense of being a juror on that same factual case, or previously being on a grand jury for the same case, and those fit in. So that's there we're talking about previously. I think if you do look at the plain language of the rule, that our Supreme Court, if they were concerned about only a current employee or employer situation, they would specifically have used that language. Sometimes we know that the legislature isn't as articulate with using past or present language, but our Supreme Court in drafting and adopting those rules would have been more specific and would have used current employee or employer if they thought that that was a differential matter in it being implicit bias. Unless the court has additional questions, I again would ask for a reversal of Mr. Anderson's convictions based on the arguments made in the brief and made today before this court. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted, and we will have a decision out within a statutory time period. Thank you for your brief.